This episode of the Gospel Coalition podcast is sponsored by Baker Books, presenting 12 Faithful Men, Portraits of Courageous Endurance and Pastoral Ministry, edited by Colin Hansen and Jeff Robinson of the Gospel Coalition. Available wherever books are sold. This is the Gospel Coalition podcast, where we seek to renew the contemporary church in the ancient gospel of Jesus Christ. I'm your host, Colin Hansen. Compared to any other place and time, we in the West enjoy unprecedented freedom thanks to philosophical, legal, economic, technological, and medical developments. Yet we're not measurably happier. We don't actually enjoy freedom. Why not? Abdul Murray says it's because, quote, through unfettered autonomy, we make ourselves into gods who are accountable to no one. And then we use our divinity to declare that we are less than human. Murray explores this paradox in his new book, Saving Truth, Finding Meaning and Clarity in a Post-Truth World. Murray earned his law degree from the University of Michigan and works as North America Director of RZIM. I especially love in this book how he describes Jesus. Listen to this. Kids rushed to play with him in the sunlit day, and religious scholars secretly met with him in the moonlit night. Women found wholeness in him, and thieves found forgiveness. Sinners were convicted by his words, but also redeemed by his actions. Jesus is the convergence of everything we wish were true about our worldviews and about ourselves. Murray joins me on the Gospel Coalition podcast to discuss our post-truth world, confirmation bias, freedom versus autonomy, and more. Abdu, thank you for joining me on the Gospel Coalition podcast.
It's been a pleasure and an honor. Thanks so much for having me.
So for many years, postmodernism was all the talk among concerned evangelicals. Explain the difference between postmodernism and the post-truth mindset.
Yeah, and this is actually such a key question, because oftentimes I think the church sort of struggles to catch up with where society is going, having spent a lot of time on one thing and then not actually addressing the issues as they arise. So a postmodern mindset and a post-truth mindset might look the same, but they're actually quite different, and the differences really do make a difference. Postmodernism was the belief, essentially, that there were no objective truths. Things were subjectively true in the sense they were true for you and relevant to your life, but any sense of an objective truth, where, let's say, I would say that my truth or my version of reality or how I think of things is objective, true, if I try to foist that upon somebody, that was considered a power move. And of course, what that results in, as the postmodern mindset would say, is that that's where all conflict comes from. The attempt to foist our objective truths or our seemingly objective truths on other people. So it's a power play. So in order to get rid of that, we have to get rid of the idea of objective truths, realize that most things are subjective, and then we can move on from there. But you can actually argue with that mindset, because if someone says, you know, there is no objective truth, of course, the follow-up question is, well, is your statement objectively true? And if it is objectively true, well, then there are objective truths, in which case you're automatically wrong. And if there are no objective truths, well, then your statement itself isn't objectively true, in which case you've said nothing. So you can actually argue with a postmodern person. And I think that that's actually happened. We've seen some great defenders of the Christian faith in general, but truth in specific, able to actually show people that a postmodern mindset is unworkable, it's unlivable, and it's actually systemically contradictory. A post-truth mindset is different, and I would even dare say more difficult to deal with, because as Oxford English Dictionary defines it, when it called its word of the year in 2016, something is post-truth if it elevates, this is essentially the meaning, if it elevates feelings and preferences over facts and truth. So they don't deny that truth exists. They don't even deny that objective truths exist, but a post-truth mindset elevates feelings and preferences over it. So whereas a post-truth mindset says there is no objective truth, sorry, when a post-modern mindset says there is no objective truth, a post-truth mindset says there is objective truth, but if it doesn't match up with my preferences and my feelings, I don't care. And it's a little different, more difficult. Yeah, it's harder to deal with.
Well, give us a couple examples of that.
Yeah. So a number of years ago, I was actually giving my testimony. I came from a Muslim background, then I became a Christian, and I was giving my testimony to a large group of people, actually. And I was talking about how I became a Christian. And there was a man who was taking some pretty serious notes in the front, and I could tell he was going to be one of the first people to talk to me after I was done, and sure enough, he was. He said, "Hey, I appreciate the way you didn't disagree with your previous worldview." And I said, well, I don't think you got the point exactly, because if I agreed with it, I would have stayed that way, and I would have saved myself and others a lot of pain. I can appreciate what you're saying, is because I actually present my message. So I became a Christian because the gospel is true, not because something else was false. They are false by implication if they come against what I think is objectively true, but I was trying to point out that Christianity was true. He said, here's my view. All of us have incomplete versions of the truth. There is a total objective truth, but all of us have incomplete versions of the truth. And therefore, I can't disagree with anybody else's version. So my response to that was, are you serious? I mean, like, what about like Hitler and Pol Pot and Joseph Stalin and Idi Amin and the KKK and all? Pick a number of people who have done horrible things based on a horrible ideology. And you're telling me you can't disagree with these people? And his statement was, I can tell you that I don't prefer their versions of the truth, but because mine is incomplete, I can't disagree. And of course, what I said back to that was, sure you can. And he said, no, I can't. And I said, you just did it. You just disagreed with me. So you can easily see how we lose our sense of reason when it comes to this stuff. But a very intelligent, by the way, very well-informed man had his preferences matter more than the truth itself. He had to have recognized by the time we were done that there is an objective truth, and it eventually will clobber you if you don't try to give it its full sway. But his preferences mattered more. And we're seeing this in other areas too. I think one of the biggest issues today is this issue of gender identity and sexuality. But now, before I begin and go any further on this, I think this is the reality. There are people who have real, legitimate, actual, I don't mean legitimate in terms of their right. I mean, they actually feel genuine either dysphoria about their gender, or they have strong same-sex attractions. And I'm not discounting the intensity of those feelings. But I think society is getting to the point where we want this unfettered freedom to do whatever we want. So despite the science that shows that there are some very serious negative consequences to certain behaviors, we kind of want to ignore that because our preferences matter more. And what I want to do trumps what I should do, or actually what the science actually educates me as to the most prudent cause of action. So I think that's the big issue in our society. And those are just two examples, but there's many, many more.
Well, you still see people sometimes referring to science, and they'll often use it as a shorthand for, this is why I'm not a quote-unquote political conservative, or why I'm not a Christian, or something like that. But so are people trying to hold together all these different worldviews at the same time? It's almost like we have this very strange mishmash of an enlightenment mentality where science is determinative of everything, and science can tell us everything that we need to know. But then at the same time, but then again, there are all these power narratives, and we have to oppose that. But then at the same time, ultimately, I just do what I feel like, and that's all that really matters there. Like, can all of these somehow coexist in the same person, or at least in the same society? Or is it more like people tend to move and progress between these stages at different times?
I think it's more the latter, actually. I think, and this is why I've actually termed this in the book, The Culture of Confusion, where we've actually embraced, we haven't actually overtly said these words, but functionally, we have embraced confusion as a virtue and clarity as a sin. And what I mean by that is essentially if we have take a dogmatic position on something, and I'm not saying dogmatism for dogmatism's sake, I'm saying we've had a careful, concerned, and concerted effort to actually discover if our worldview is true, and then try to be consistent across science, faith, social interaction, justice issues, and all these things. If we try to be clear and establish a clarity across all these things, that's somehow considered dogmatistic, intolerant, bigoted, or even regressive. But if we're confused, we're allowed to play at the fuzzy edges. And so we can borrow from science when it's convenient. We can reject science when it doesn't match our preferences. Then we can say, okay, we have a certain level of spirituality, whatever that happens to mean to us. But that doesn't have to be consistent with my actual outworkings of how I view the social realm or climate change science or whatever it might be. We're becoming, I think schizophrenic might be too strong of a word, but in some ways we are. We move and shift from various areas when it suits our convenience or suits our agenda. That's the epitome of a post-truth culture.
Okay.
Because we, So I think that we're shifting all the time. And what I'm trying to do in the book is actually bring different realms of looking at things, like science and faith, like religious pluralism, like freedom, what it means to be human, sexuality, and saying, how can we be consistent across these things while at the same time recognizing where the actual facts and the truth lie?
Yeah, so that explains one of the other questions I was planning to ask here. You write that clarity has become the vice of the day. But I was wondering how you squared that with the fact that our society actually seems really clear on certain moral issues, such as, for example, abuse of children or women and overt racism. You would see that then as simply part of that preference and part of that culture of confusion. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that what the clarity that we see in society isn't so much a clarity in terms of consistency of position or I've thought this through. It's more of a clarity of I know what my position is, and if you disagree with me, you're Adolf Hitler or you're, you know, Joseph Stalin. It's not a matter of do you have reasons for your views. It's that these are my views, and no matter what facts you give me or no matter how compassionately you actually express your view, you don't agree with me, and therefore somehow you're on the wrong side of history or you're evil or something like this. So we are clear on one thing, and that is that we are very much opposed to anybody who disagrees with us, and we actually start to vilify them. And by the way, that's not a left mentality. People on the right assume that the left tells lies. People on the left assume the right tells lies. And people who are centrist assume the right and the left are always telling lies. We've polarized ourselves because of our clarity that we're always right and someone else is always wrong. So I think that that's, we're clear on that.
So how do you exactly have a society this way? Or maybe you don't, and that's exactly what we're seeing right now.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think that you're right. This is where we're sort of, I would even say, devolving to, where, you know, when you look at the philosophers of law, the people who brought us the ideas of why do we even have human law in the first place, like John Stuart Mill and Locke and Rousseau and Thomas Hobbes and all these guys, what they were trying to do was get us out of the state of nature where, you know, might makes right and nature is red in tooth and claw and the strong dominate the weaker. They're trying to get us out of that and into the rule of society, of civilization, where we weren't based on power. We were based on law and fairness, and even the weak have a say, so to speak, whether they're the weak in terms of their influence or they're the weak literally physically. We were trying to get out of that. What we're returning to now is, when preferences matter more than truth, is we're returning to the state of autonomy, where we don't want freedom. Freedom requires boundaries. It necessarily does. We want autonomy. And of course, that comes from two Greek words, autos meaning self, nomos meaning law. So when I'm a law unto myself and someone else is a law unto themselves, and preferences matter more than facts and truth, well, when my law, my personal law, conflicts with somebody else, the arbiter between us to tell us who's right and who's wrong won't be truth. It'll be power, because truth is subordinated to my preferences. So if I happen to have the biggest microphones, or in some societies, the most guns, or the most advocates on my side, I win. Not by virtue of the truth of my position, but by virtue of the influence I have. You cannot have a society like that. That is the law of nature. That's the law of the jungle. That's where we wanted to come from. And we find ourselves sort of even using, strangely enough, the law to get ourselves back to a might makes right mentality. And that's not society. That's just animal existence.
So let me... This just occurred to me while you were talking. Have you watched any of the kind of the interviews, the police interviews with Larry Nassar about his abuse?
I didn't watch the police interviews. No.
Okay. I don't know if you've seen any of that, but it makes me wonder if that's an example. It seemed that Nassar, for the most part, never really actually saw anything wrong with what he was doing. It seemed like at some level he was convinced that what he was doing, and that's kind of what I'm wondering there, is it just a ploy? Like, is it just a ploy to be able to get away with things? Or is it far more deceptive than that? Like, is it an actual lived, embodied truth that is like just almost impenetrable? I mean, I'm thinking about your book, and I'm wondering about the apologetic enterprise, and I'm thinking, how do you evangelize your neighbors when they're looking for reasons not to believe? They can't even disagree with you.
Right.
They just, because of their preferences, they're like, I don't really. It actually, to draw on another example, it reminds me of Dostoevsky's presentation of Ivan Karamazov in his Rejection of Christ. He's like, no, like, I get it. I acknowledge that it's all true, and that's why I reject it, because mm-hmm. I don't want anything to do with that.
Yeah. I think that's you know, you look at some of these classics. Isn't it amazing how prescient they were?
Right.
Almost prophetic in some of these things.
Right.
And I think I think you're hitting it on the head, is that the trouble right now, and the reason why I was hoping to actually show some hope throughout the book too, not just diagnose the issue, but as you offer some hope and a method for how do you evangelize, and because it's steeped in apologetics, the defense of the Christian faith, I wanted to give a method also for saying, how do you actually talk to people who don't seem to want the truth? And I think the way you do that is by appealing to one of the other chief virtues of the day, which is pragmatism. Do it if it feels good, if it doesn't hurt anybody, and if it works for you. And the thing I want to seize on is that last one, if it works for you. Well, the reality is a culture of preferences, a post-truth culture of preferences and autonomy simply doesn't work. So I think one of the methods we can do, there's two broad methods. One, show the negative consequences of a post-truth world, and then show the hope that can be given and be brought back with a truth-based society. So three of the consequences off the top of my head, well, actually not top of my head, I wrote them in a book, are the loss of reason, and I already pointed out a couple of examples about how very intelligent, well-meaning people, when they elevate their preferences over the truth, lose their sense of reason. We lose our sense of reason. The second thing is we lose all sense of accountability. I mean, because you think about it, if I'm autonomous and I'm a law unto myself, who then am I accountable to? I might say society, but what I really mean is society in so much as it serves me. And the minute it doesn't, I can come against it and all these things, maybe even secretively. So we lack any kind of accountability. And Protagoras, this is an age-old human thing. Protagoras said it centuries ago, didn't he? Man is the measure of all things. If man is a measure of all things, because the gods really aren't there to actually sort of give us any kind of divine command, and certainly from a Christian perspective, they would say no God exists, well, then I am the determiner of all that is good, right, wrong, evil, moral, and all these things, if such things even exist. So I think that's one thing, another consequence. And then what results from that is we lack then any sense of human value. We've started to devalue each other. So from lack of reason to lack of accountability, ultimately into lack of human value. And it's becoming so very tough out there that I think we're running into very serious problems. Where secular humanists would say we come to rough agreement concerning values, quoting Tom Flynn, I think we haven't come to a rough agreement concerning values except for the value that we've agreed to be rough. And I think that's the problem.
You make it sound like one of the prophets of our age then would be Dr. Phil. How's that working out for you? But I'm just imagining, how is a relationship? I'm saying parent with children, children with parents, dating relationships, friendships, marriages. How exactly is that supposed to work when the guiding principle is preference with the goal of autonomy? You're only useful to me so long as you serve my autonomy, and therefore then I continue to, and just only so long as I prefer to be with you.
Yeah. Well, I think that the tough part there is that people don't actually overtly say such things or even think, although sometimes I've run into people who actually do say such things. But it's a subtle thing, isn't it? That's why it's so insidious, is that it's subtle and we don't even realize we're doing it. I think that for a parent-child relationship or even a husband-wife relationship or a brother, sister, whatever it is, or friends, I think the way to do this, actually to engage in this, is to realize something. There are things that people actually do care about, and they do try to link themselves and even their autonomous decisions to a greater state of well-being. So for example, whether it's sexual autonomy, the ability to do whatever we want, well, why do people want that? Essentially, they want it for selfish reasons. But the other reason they want it is because they actually think that freedom in these senses is a good thing. So they're playing on an objective moral good, even if they don't realize it. And I think what we draw on the Apostle Paul's words when he says, we walk in wisdom toward outsiders, making the best use of the time, letting our speech be gracious, seasoned with salt, so we may know how we ought to answer each person. That's the key. He doesn't say how to answer each issue or each controversy. He says how to answer each person. So if that's the case, I think the hard work of doing this kind of evangelism and doing this kind of apologetics is actually listening to what someone cares about, seeing a common ground upon which you can come and talk, whether it's the sense of what freedom actually is, or that human beings should have dignity, or whatever it might be. People tend to agree on these things. Then say, okay, what is a justifiable basis for these things? In other words, affirm that which is affirmable in someone else. And then say, the gospel, and I think the gospel alone, actually offers some kind of a justification for the things you care about. Then we can begin to talk about that. On the racism issue, I remember talking with somebody who had become an atheist because when he found he was an adopted guy, from a black family, but he got adopted by white parents. He found his birth father, who was very militant, very upset, very angry, and said that Christianity is the slaver's religion. And he said, I reject Christianity and God in general because it allows for slavery. And my question back was, how can you justify your outrage? You're justifiable, I believe, outrage at racism if we are just chemical machines that bump into each other, or if our evolutionary process might makes right. And we had a wonderful discussion because his preference was based on the sense of justice. And he let that override, I think, the truth of the gospel. So find something to affirm. I think that's the way to go.
So let's talk about the human devaluing part right there. So kind of the culmination there that you mentioned just a bit ago. And mm-hmm. So I fully agree with this statement from you. And I think it's probably the harshest one in the whole book. I want to read it in whole. In our confused quest to elevate ourselves to deities, we actually have become devils. We've commoditized the most vulnerable members of our species and consumed them as a burnt offering to self-appeasement. Now, I'm not sure. I know of a better example of Romans 1 in our day, or a more destructive connection to the worst parts of Israel's history, and the examples that have given above all of their capitulation to the ways of the nations, namely through the sacrifice of their own children. And that was to appease certain gods to get certain results. And that's the same thing in our day, to be able to appease the gods of ourselves, essentially. How do we help people to see this? I mean, in one sense, it should be abundantly obvious. Like, this is an evil that I don't really, I can't find any remote even benefit or positive offshoot from it. It's like you take the most vulnerable people who are flesh of our flesh, the very things, the most precious thing that's been entrusted to us, and we murder them in the most vulnerable place. How are we supposed to talk about this, tell people to understand, when it seems there's like this incredible just spiritual blindness and moral blindness that's descended on us?
It's incredibly difficult. If it wasn't difficult, we wouldn't have, I think, the abortion on demand that we have today. I think that we wouldn't have the situations we're finding ourselves in. Someone would have figured out a way to start the clarion call and wake everybody up out of these things. But it's what is very difficult. I think the key, though, is to show them essentially what is the sense of human dignity and where does it come from? Because I think what the culture has done is that we have, in elevating ourselves to deities, we've now determined what's valuable. And by the way, this is not new. Adam and Eve tried this. The post-truth culture had its seedlings sown in the Garden of Eden, actually, when they wanted to become God, not be with God. That's a post-truth mindset. Their preferences mattered more than the truth, and we're still living with that. That's part of the human condition. I think now, when we give it a full vent and full flourishment to this culture of confusion and autonomy, we've become little gods in and of ourselves. That's why Yuval Harari, for example, has written a book called Deus Homo, or Homo Deus, it might be, where he's talking about how we are the man, God from man. So we devalue people. In fact, we have people like Peter Singer and Alberto Giubilini and Francesca Minerva who are actually arguing with a straight face that parents should be able to kill not preborn babies, but newborn babies, because they're just Their reasoning is that if the baby does not have the cognitive abilities to value itself, and then no other human being values the baby, then the baby has no value. So in other words, value is derivative of human beings. I think the way to actually to counter this is to say, let's be consistent now. If human beings determine the value of something else, then can it be the case that a collection of human beings can determine the value of other human beings, whether pre-born or post-birth, no matter even if they're adults, because they happen to be in my way? How do you justify these things and begin to see, because I think that this human dignity issue is very important. And we're just pointing out the confusion here. If we claim to be these deities who are self-autonomous, but then we reduce ourselves to mere chemical machines, how can we possibly live in such a state, a confused state? And we're not. We're actually killing the most vulnerable of us. And we're not even doing it in the womb. We're doing it outside the womb. Mm. So I think that the way forward is to start out with that issue of what does it mean to be made in God's image? And by the way, that bleeds over into so many other issues, like the racism is we see today. How do we justify our anger at racism if we're just blobs of chemicals, as I said before? Well, I think the great equalizer is that we are made in God's image, not unequally distributed chemical machines. We are actually made in God's image, and no amount of physicality and no amount of brute strength or political force can ever take that from us. That's what gives us that equality. And if that's the case, then it is imbued upon us and is imbued to us at our conception, not just at our birth. I think we have to get that image of God thing back. I think it's really important. We get that back, I think we can make headway.
Couple questions here with Abdu Murray, author of Saving Truth, Finding Meaning and Clarity in a Post-Truth World. So I look, and despite all of this progress that I alluded to before, this advance of freedom, I don't see a lot of optimism from people, not about the world or not about each other. Yet we still think the reigning philosophical belief seems to be that we can find the solutions to what's wrong with us within ourselves and in better programs and in systems. Why can't we seem to see, as you advocate for in this book, that the solution to these problems and ultimately to our very problem with God needs to come from outside of ourselves?
Yeah, and that's one of the most difficult things, isn't it? Because that is, if we were to say what is essentially the inherent original sin, and I don't mean original as in first, I mean original as in like original to us, in and of ourselves. And it's not original to us in the sense that Satan did it, of course, himself. I think that it is this condition where we want to be our own saviors, and we wanted to be God in the garden, and we want to be God now. So we have a hard time seeing, even believers I've talked to have a hard time seeing that they can't be the solution to their own problems. I think the way to talk about this is to say, so let me ask you a question. Is it the case that you have ever been your actual own savior? In what way has that actually happened for you? Again, Dr. Phil sort of thing, how's that working out for you? But I think that we have to ask ourselves, do you see yourself as the problem? I mean, time and time again, we see it in the media, we see it everywhere, where people say, oh, people don't really change. That's true. They actually don't really change, absent something from outside themselves that changes them. Do you have minor changes in people's lives? Yes, of course. You have addicts getting off of drugs. You have people who have sort of gone under anger management classes. But fundamental important changes that turn their complete life around, absent some kind of divine intervention, I think is fleetingly rare, if not non-existent. So we have to see that we are the problem. Logically speaking, if we're the problem, how can we possibly be the solution? We're not contributing to the problem. It's not our thoughts that are our problem. It's us that's the problem. My friend, philosopher of religion, once said that people think that we have a spiritual unhealthiness where we need to get on the treadmill. No, we have a spiritual heart problem. We need to get into the operating room. And that's the biggest difference. I think we can point that out and say, with all of our sophistication, and as you pointed out, you know, how sophisticated we've become in terms of our technology, in terms of our programs, is the world any better than it was before? Steven Pinker says so, but then you look at John Gray, an atheist, and he says, are you kidding? We've just figured out better and more convenient ways to bomb each other from a distance now. We've become not Homo sapiens, but Homo rapiens. And this is a an atheist speaking about the human condition. So if we take a stark, hard look at ourselves, I think we have to have the self-reflection to say, despite our genius and all these things, we have not come to this place. I mean, think about it. You hold a phone in your hand, and this machine that we laughingly call a phone, which no one makes calls on it. it's got more computing power in it than the rockets that went to the moon, the first rockets that went to the moon. And yet, what have we done? We've humanized these objects. We call them by name, and we call out to them. And what do we do with these humanized objects? We use them to objectify people by looking at things we shouldn't look at, and looking at people who are caught in a sex trafficking industry for our delight and our pure pleasure. So in humanizing objects, we've dehumanized people. And I can't imagine a more stark example of the fact that we cannot be our own solution. We need someone who's not us to save us from us.
Just one more question here with Abdu Murray. So we miss Nabil Qureshi, the previous guest on the Gospel Coalition podcast. I know the two of you were close. What do you continue to cherish about Nabil's tragically brief time among us?
Boy, where do I start with that? But I'll be brief. You know, I look at Nabil's legacy, and I'm glad it's continuing. You know, his wife, Michelle, is working very hard to make sure his ministry stays out there. Nabil's boldness, he was a fierce defender of truth, even when it wasn't convenient. And I think this is an important thing for us to take as a lesson, is that it's not always convenient to be an advocate for truth, because the preference culture will come against you. Now, Nabil didn't address those issues specifically. He spoke in terms of religious differences in Islam, but he spoke boldly about it, even when it cost him, even sometimes his own safety. I say in the book, you know, integrity is the currency of truth, and courage is its backbone. You cannot convey integrity, a truth, without integrity and living the truth you claim to believe. But it's going to be very, very difficult in the days to come. It's already difficult. And if one thing Nabil taught us, I think, it's that we should do it even when it's difficult. In fact, because it's difficult. And the other thing that I'll miss about him so much is that we often shared our most important times over meals. And he would look at me with that smile. And after we had already eaten dinner and we're at a conference together and we're done speaking, we've eaten just 2 hours before. And he looks at me and he smiles at me with that wry smile. And he says, come on. And that means we got to go eat some more. So that was my cherished memories of Nabil, is the wonderful meals we had together.
Well, he was a good friend of the Gospel Coalition and a great guest, and his work continues to shape us and continues to do work for which I'm grateful that the Lord has given us those kinds of publishing means, that his legacy and his teaching and his work, though too brief here on earth, continues as he lives with Jesus now in heaven. So, well, thank you, Abdu. Again, the book, Saving Truth, Finding Meaning and Clarity in a Post-Truth World. Very grateful for your ministry. Thanks for joining us on the Gospel Coalition podcast.
Thanks for having me on. Great work you guys are doing.
You've been listening to the Gospel Coalition podcast. For more gospel-centered resources, visit thegospelcoalition.org. Support for this podcast comes from listeners like you. Learn more and join us at tgc.org/donate.